one of the problems that comes with writing something down and having somebody read it later is that you can't capture the tone with which things are said. I've written this quote from Pam, but the tone was uncaptured. Maybe there have been a few moments in the history of this class where words were better said with better tone, but I don't remember them. This was just great. Okay. I do want to thank you for being here. Just in case you have forgotten, we're slowly going through the Bible a little bit at a time. We've made it to 2 Samuel, and we are looking today at 2 Samuel 15, but I want to back up to 2 Samuel 13 just to make sure you remember the context we built from last week. David had 6 sons by 6 women. When he lived in Hebron, he had a bunch more sons by more women when he lived in Jerusalem. And if you want an overarching term, and this term probably applies for a long time, palace intrigue is about as good a term as you can find. David appears to have been a somewhat distant father. Misbehavior by his children, and that is a very light word for a very strong behavior problem. Seems to have been the order of the day. Indulgence might be another word that could be used. Chapter 13, his oldest son decided that he just had to have, in the biblical sense, the sister of the third son, and took her by deception and intrigue, raped her, and then the moment that was over, verse 15 of chapter 13, it says he hated her with a hate that was greater than the love that he previously had loved her with, which allows you to conclude it wasn't ever love in the first place. It was lust. This was followed several years later by the murder of that first son by the third son, the brother of the violated woman. He ran to his grandfather in another place, one of the husband of the father of his mother, and lived there in exile for a long time. As we left things off last time, he had been brought back, but was brought back more or less under house arrest. Sort of a you can't leave town kind of thing. And I want to move now to chapter 15, where we're going to start. We just finished last time in chapter 14 that he had been back, but he had not been allowed to see the king. He had been basically under house arrest, and he's now been released from that with a kind of pardon from his father, the king, and that king was David. Chapter 15 begins, in my translation, with the words, "after this." So it doesn't state the period of time that goes by. A little bit later, you're going to find all the things that we're talking about in here took about 4 more years. Okay? This is not an idle comment. Has the campaign for the presidential election in 2016 begun?
Yes.
You bet. How long is it between presidential elections?
4 years.
It is probably not a coincidence that it's a 4-year period. That seems to be about right for the politics in the country that we live in. And that is what Absalom did. I don't know if you've done your duty. What was your assignment?
Read
at least the next few chapters, right? After this, Absalom procured a chariot and horses, along with 50 men to do what? To run ahead of him. What picture comes to your mind?
He's going to follow me.
The limousine driving down the street with the Secret Service sort of packed around. That's the picture. It's a chariot and horses instead of a suburban SUV with horses under the hood. And what does it say in the second verse? He would get up early and stand behind the road leading to the city gate. Where do politicians go now? They go stand outside factories, of which there are unfortunately fewer than there used to be. They will stand outside of places of work. They'll stand and watch people coming to work. And what does it say? Whenever a man with some lawsuit had to come before the king's tribunal, Absalom would call out to him and ask, "What town are you from?" So the picture you have is he stationed himself at a place where he could see the people who had issues with the government. And he would call out to him and say, "What town are you from?" And if he answered, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." Now pause, because I think there's a subtle point here. When he says Israel, one of the towns of Israel, what do you think he meant?
The 12 tribes.
And I don't think so. I think it's the 10. The break between the northern and southern is already coming.
Yeah.
I think he's talking about from those 10 northern tribes. I think the break is actually already here. I've pointed out to you a few places already where you can sort of see the fracture lines. "Your servant is one of the tribes of Israel." Then Absalom would say, he wouldn't say it if they were from the other part, but he would say it if they were from that part, "Look, your case is sound and just." Would that be true? Occasionally. "Your case is sound and just, but nobody in the king's deputies is going to listen to you." And then he would say, what does it say in yours? Does yours start with, "Oh"? Right? You can't capture the tone, can you? "Oh, that someone would appoint me judge in the land. Then anyone with a lawsuit or a plea could come to me, and I would see that he would have justice." And what's going to be in the minds of the person that hears this? Oh, if you were in charge, I would have my place vindicated. Is that true? Base it on your experience. Don't base it on back here. Is that true? Occasionally. Let me try to teach you. What's the answer to that question? Is that true? Occasionally. Right? "And whenever anyone came up to him to bow before him, to prostrate himself, he would stretch out his hand, draw him to himself, and kiss him. He acted like this with every Israelite who appealed to the king's tribunal." And in this way, something happened. What does it say happened?
Stole,
your translation says. That's better than mine. Mine says he won the hearts of the Israelites. Stole it is better. Stole it from whom? From David. You've only had 6 verses so far. We got several chapters to go. What's just happened? One of the great politicians the world has ever seen is at work. And what does he put on display? He puts on display wealth and power. "I've got a chariot. I've got 50 men walking alongside me."
Wasn't everybody else riding mules at that point?
If they were lucky.
Yeah.
Right? The king's sons were riding mules.
Yeah.
Right? Mules must equate to Bentleys and Maseratis and something like that. Right?
Bill, you were talking to politicians. I called one of the senators one time and asked for a bill, a copy of a bill, so I could read it. And a little gal told me, she said, "Would you understand it if I send it to you?"
I think that's a fair question. I would agree with that. Let me be real careful here. There's some people in this room who work as lawyers. You want to be a judge? You want to be a judge? I don't think they pay judges enough. I think that's a hard, cruel thing. The pressures are on you from every possible direction. Right? I almost think we should never elect anybody who really wants to have the job that we're electing for. That's a little cynical. But I think we really want somebody who doesn't want it, but who will do it out of either a sense of duty or a sense of gratitude for the country in which they live. It's like Washington, it's like Richmond, it's like Chesterfield County, and it's like, how far down do you want to go?
I'm saying George Washington.
Interesting picture. George, they wanted to make him king, and he refused. They made him president. He said, "I'll be president, but only for a short while. I don't want to set up sort of a constitutional monarchy." I think that's a good thing to say. In any event, what you are seeing is a master politician. What did he present to the people? Let's just review for a moment. We can't review because we only did one point. What's the first thing he presented?
Wealth
and power and privilege. What else did he present? Go to the last of these. I may be wealthy and powerful, but what? But you're my best friend. And oh, do I value you. He had the ability to make each person feel personally connected. Okay? A very long time ago, I'm looking at Allison to make sure she remembers this moment. They had a presidential debate at the University of Richmond. Allison was up to her ears in arranging for it. They had 9,000 seats plus the floor in the Robbins Center. They were going to televise this thing. At the end of the day, 200 people from the university community had a lottery of sorts to get tickets to go. I was one of the ones who got one of those 200 tickets. I saw this. I came home and I told Barbara, Bill Clinton's going to win the next election. I didn't say that on the basis of his qualifications. I said that on the basis of his connection to people. We would call that charisma these days. The ability to make a personal connection. He made each person he spoke to. You could feel it from where I was sitting. I wasn't one of the ones on the floor asking questions. I was just witnessing from up in the distance. One of the best politicians I've ever seen. I don't know if he's one of the best leaders the country has ever had. I'll leave that for other debates. But as far as being able to present as Absalom is presenting, present himself, I have wealth, I have power, I have influence, and you are my best friend, and therefore if you support me, my power and my influence will turn to your benefit and your good. That's the way it works. It is, in my opinion, unfortunate, sad, and probably tragic and destructive, but that's the way it works, and that ain't new. That's very, very, very old. Yes, ma'am.
I was wondering.
Were you?
Yes. And Hillary Clinton was talking to her, gave her my name, and she said, oh, I've heard that name before. Do you think anybody has ever heard of that? She said, oh, yeah.
And I want to be careful here. There are people who have an unusual degree of empathy. And I'm not saying this is false. What have I taught you is the answer to the question of, is it true?
Occasionally
it is. I think there are people who are able to make an enormous number of personal connections. George W. on the other side had a nickname for everybody I hear. And that nickname helped him remember things about that. Lyndon Johnson had his Rolodex. And it was, you look back at the people who have power and influence, very often it's because of how many people they know, both high and low. And the power base isn't high, the power base is both. I'm just inviting you to look and see these first six verses are not ancient. They are contemporary. There's parallels here right now. He acted like this, verse 6 said, with every Israelite. I'm suggesting to you that's the northern tribes. I don't think Israel here means everybody. Look carefully. Who would have had business with the king's deputies at the king's tribunal? It would have been the citizens of the country. But he was picking out a portion of his base. And at the end, what did he do? He won or stole the hearts of the Israelites. Every single one of them? No. But most of them. Most of them. Verse 7 tells you what? 4 years. Absalom said to the king, please let me go to Hebron. Now he's out of house arrest, but what's he under? There's an implication because he's asking the king for permission. He's not under house arrest anymore. But what is it? Oh, come on. You've seen enough Dragnet. Well, maybe not you, but maybe not you. But a number of you have seen enough Dragnet episodes. What is it?
Don't leave town.
Right. Don't leave town. There's house arrest, and then there's don't leave town. Right. He's now under don't leave town. And what did he say? I'd like to go to Hebron. And what's his excuse? I'm still in verse 7. To fulfill a vow that he made to the Lord. For when I was in Geshur, your servant made this vow, if the Lord brings me back to Jerusalem, I will pay my devotions to the Lord in Hebron. And the king said, go in peace, and off he went. Did he go in peace? Have you read your scripture? Did he go in peace? He did not. Had he made a vow to the Lord? Not clear, but probably not. Why did he want to get out of town? Why did he want to go to Hebron? Because Hebron's in Israel. Hebron is in that part of the country where he's been working. He had to wait for people to come. He was out of house arrest, but he couldn't leave Jerusalem. He had to wait for people to come to Jerusalem. So he was watching people come from up that way. They come to Jerusalem, I make sure I meet them. I get to know them. Right? Where's the first place politicians go these days? There's two answers. There's two answers. New Hampshire and Iowa. That's the first place they go is one of those two places, right? And they get to know people, right? So if people from New Hampshire and Iowa come into Washington, I got a feeling they get a little more attention than people from Tennessee or people from Virginia, as noble as Virginia is. Verse 10, Absalom sent couriers throughout the tribes of Israel to say, when you hear the trumpet sound, you are to shout, Absalom is king at Hebron. With Absalom went 200 men from Jerusalem. He's up from 50 to 200 now. They had been invited and had gone, mine says, in all innocence. What does yours say? Unaware of what is going on. Does your translation say that? Knew nothing about what was happening. 200 men from Jerusalem had gone with him. They didn't have any idea of what was coming. Absalom sent for Ahithophel. Keep an eye on Ahithophel. He's going to show up a bit more. The Gilonite, sounds like kryptonite, David's counselor from Gilo, his town, and had him with him while offering the sacrifices. The conspiracy, that's the first time it's named for what it is, the conspiracy grew in strength since Absalom's supporters grew in number. Verse 13, a messenger came to David. What did the messenger say? Mine says, the men of Israel have shifted their allegiance to Absalom.
The hearts of the men.
David said, put on your armor, folks. We're going to go put this rebellion down. Because David is a strong and powerful king with a strong and powerful army with him. That's what he said, right? What did he say? I have a friend, I'm not going to tell you who he is, who has the habit of calling other friends, and when they answer the phone, he says, all has been discovered. Flee for your life. My own sense is that every once in a while he gets a reaction, but I haven't heard for sure. What's David doing? You've read it, right? Or most of you have read it, right? What does David do? I'm at verse 14. You can read it all right there if you haven't looked at it before. What does he say? But let us flee, or we will not escape from Absalom. Leave as quickly as you can in case he mounts a sudden attack, overcomes us, and puts the city to the sword. And the people of the king's army said, oh, come on, king. We've got plenty of power to push him back. What are you so worried about? Right? That's what the army said back, right?
No.
Absolutely not. What did they say?
We're
already ahead of you, king. We're packed. Now I want to ask a very serious question. What in the world just happened? David has been pushing down. Yeah, we can't call it a coup because then we can't give them foreign aid. You all do know this, right? If you call it a coup, then you can't give them the $1.8 billion in foreign aid that you give them every year. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go look up coup and foreign aid. Okay. Where does Absalom get that kind of power that he frightens David into running? What's missing in David's story? What's missing in David's story? I trained you months ago. Did it work? What did David not do?
He did not consult God.
There is no record of him consulting God. He simply runs.
I don't understand why David didn't know what his son was doing. It just doesn't make any sense. He didn't have an idea that his son was stealing power.
Was he so blind? Maybe David had
a blind spot for Absalom. I know that. But still,
David. The picture you have is David wasn't paying attention, whatever particular form that took.
I find that because David was such. You know, up until this point, he was a man who knew what was going on and so forth and so on and.
I'm expressing to you that this is incredible, but the Bible says this is what happened. When word of this came, David's first and only response is to flee for his life. The power has totally shifted. Time out for a minute. I think this matters. I've been thinking about this. I think this matters. Where was Absalom from? He's part of David's family. Right? And his mother is from this country way over there where he ran for his original exile. Right? So where's Absalom's home base, so to speak? Inside the country, I'm using the country rather than Israel because we're using the word Israel for the 10. Where is Absalom's base himself? It would be the same as David's base. Where's that?
Judah.
Not Jerusalem, Judah. Everybody okay? Absalom's power base is here. He's added the power base there. David, I think, is sensing if I stay here, his local power base is going to be powerful enough to take us because I haven't been paying attention. This guy's got friends everywhere. He's got supporters everywhere. It's not so much that he has built a power base in Israel as much as he had added one. I'm reading that into the Bible text. So I'm inviting you to simply look and see whether you agree. But that's what I see. Please look at verse 16, first five or six or seven words. It says something powerfully interesting here. What does it say? Haven't seen it yet. You're glossing right over it. You're glossing over the big key thing.
So the king went out and the house fell.
Well, maybe yours doesn't say it. Let me read your mind. The king set out on foot. And there's two other translations that say that too. Verse 17, the king set out on foot, repeats it. What are his kids riding? Oh yes, it said way back. What do his kids ride? Those mules. What's Absalom riding? A chariot with horses and with all the men around him, right? I believe this has an element of truth to it. I've seen it in enough translations to where I think it might be right. The king set out on foot. The king set out on foot. How fast can you move on foot? Compared to how fast you can move if you're mounted. Yeah. That's a problem. And you're going to watch that problem grow. He set out on foot with his whole household, leaving 10 concubines behind to look after the palace. He set out on foot with everyone following, and they halted at the last house. What's the last house? I don't know. I don't know if that's the last house within the compound. Maybe he had places for other people to live within the palace walls. Maybe this is the last house at the edge of Jerusalem. They're on the way out, and they're sort of gathering people. I don't know which that means. Verse 18, all of his officers stood at his side. All of his officers stood at his side. Some translations say marched past. So if yours says that, that's another translation. And then it names the Cherulithites and the Pelethites and the Cherulthites, or however you pronounce that. Those appear to be sort of the home guard, the bodyguard plus the soldiers assigned to the palace. Okay, either stood there or moved by. And verse 19, you meet Ittai the Gittite. Love his name. Ittai the Gittite. Who's Ittai the Gittite? The king says something very interesting to him. What does he say? What are you doing going with us? You're a foreigner. Ittai the Gittite. Go back and stay with the king, for you're a foreigner, indeed an exile from your homeland. You only arrived yesterday. Should I take you wandering with us today? Yesterday probably doesn't mean 24 hours ago. Mm-hmm. Yesterday probably means a short time ago.
Just return and remain with the king. He's the king.
Did you pick that up?
Yeah. He says,
did you pick that up?
He's abdicating.
What is that? He's acknowledging what he senses as reality. Absalom's the king. I want you to see what David is saying. David's throwing in the towel. He's running. Duck and run. Yeah, I learned duck and cover at one point in my life. Some of you did as well. Go back and stay with the king. You only arrived yesterday or a short time ago. Should I take you wandering with us today when I don't even know myself where I'm going? Go back, take your faithful countrymen with you, and may the Lord show you mercy and faithful love. At the end of the day, Ittai the Gittite has made a powerful commentary that almost rises to the level of Ruth. As the Lord lives and as my Lord the King lives, wherever the Lord my King may be, for death or life, your servant will be there too. And Ittai, and they finally tell you the particular town he's from. Where's he from?
Gath.
Remember Gath in David's history? With all his men and all his children too, the entire population was weeping aloud as the king stood in the bed of the Kidron River Valley, and everybody marched past him making for the desert. Wow. Just like that, David had been at peace, it seemed like, with all the people around him, by putting down all of their armies and all their powers. And from his own family, somebody came up. Nathan the prophet foretold this when he confronted David over Bathsheba and the sin with Uriah and Bathsheba. Verse 24. Somebody else was there. Zorro. Well, it's not Zorro, but it's close. Zadok. It may be Zadok, but today we're going to call it Zadok. He was there, and all the Levites were with him, and they were carrying something. What were they carrying? Okay, you've read this, right? What does David say? Take it back. If God wants me to see the Ark of the Covenant again, he'll let me. And I'll see it in Jerusalem. Verse 27, but he adds a little something. Verse 26, should the Lord say, you displease me? Here I am, let him treat me as he sees fit. Verse 27, the king said to Zadok the priest, look though, you and Abiathar, who's Abiathar? He's the other leading priest. You guys go back quietly into the city with your two sons and names them. You might keep an eye on the sons. You see, I'll wait in the passes of the desert plain until word comes from me bringing news. What's he asking them to do?
Be spies.
Okay. David then made his way up. I'm at verse 30. Up what? Mount of Olives. Weeping as he went, his head covered and his feet bare. They're telling you one more time in my translation that he was barefoot and walking. That's a sign of mourning. All the people with him had their heads covered. Doesn't say that they were barefoot. They were weren't quite as tough as he was. Made their way up weeping as they went. David was then informed that Ahithophel was among the conspirators with Absalom. One of his trusted counselors was actually betraying him and counseling Absalom. And David prayed for the first time. What's his prayer? Mine says, turn his advice to folly. How does yours read that? But, not trusting God to do that completely on his own, verse 32 tells you what? As he reached the summit where God is worshipped, there must have been a spot out there somewhere. It tells you about a sanctuary that had been there for a long, long time, outside the walls of Jerusalem, up at the top of the Mount of Olives, it looks like. He saw somebody. Who did he see? We're going to agree on Hushai? Hushai? Why-shai? When-shai? What-shai? How-shai? Hushai, the Archite, his friend, coming to meet him with his tunic torn and with earth on his head. David said, if you go along with me, you'll be a burden to me. I'm going to be worrying about you as much as I worry about myself. And I don't know whether there's questions of age and infirmity that might have been with this. But, he says, if you go back into the city and say to Absalom, I'm at your service, my lord king. Notice he's calling him king for the second time. Once I was in your father's service, but now I will serve you. You will be able to thwart Ahithophel's advice for me. So he's prayed to the Lord to turn Ahithophel's advice to folly, but he's also sent in somebody to try to help the Lord along with that task. Surely the priests Zadok and Abiathar will be with you. Anything you hear from the palace, you must report to the priests. Their two sons are with them. And three. He has now told this guy, he has trusted this guy with the whole chain of spies that's going to be bringing word out to him. That's trust. Because they could, as they say, round up that particular group of spies easily. Verse 37, last verse of chapter 15. Hushai, David's friend, entered the city just as Absalom was reaching Jerusalem. How close is Absalom on the heels of David? Close. Real close. How far is David going? Not very far. And he's going to wait there to get word of what happens. Chapter 16 begins some interesting things, and I'm going to pull in just a little bit of this before we sort of do some finishing thing today. A little bit past the summit, so not very far from where we just left off. Okay, so you sort of see Absalom coming in. David is over the Mount of Olives, but not very far. Absalom's coming in, and I don't remember the directions. Mount of Olives, I think, is to the west of that, but I don't remember that for sure. So maybe they're coming in from the northeast. David had passed a little beyond the summit, and Meribaal's retainer, Ziba. You remember Ziba from the other day? He comes with a pair of donkeys, saddled and laden with 200 loaves of bread. Starts to talk about all the food he's brought. And the king says to Ziba, great question. Have you read that question in yours? Did your ears perk up just a little bit? What are you going to do with all that? The donkeys, Ziba replied, are for the king's family to ride. How many donkeys were there? I just thought I'd check that. Mine said a pair of donkeys back in the first version.
Mine says a string.
A string. Well, I think a string would be better because I've been worried about this for about a month. There's a pair of donkeys in his family. Either it means none of his family is going with him. He had a whole bunch of sons, right? I don't know about them. Pair of donkeys or a string of donkeys. I like a string of donkeys, but I hadn't seen that. And the bread and the fruit are for the soldiers to eat. The wine is for drinking by those who get exhausted in the desert. And the king asked, and where is your master's son? And Ziba replied to the king, he stayed in Jerusalem. He says, this is a happy day. I'm going to get all my lands back. What has he just done? He has just slandered and denounced Meribaal. Does Meribaal deserve this? The answer starts with W. We don't know. Neither does the king.
But one of the translations that Ziba was a servant of Mephibosheth, which is...
Yeah, I'm sorry. Let's go back. Mephibosheth is the way some translations write the name.
Okay.
Meribaal is the way other translations write the name. I should have said that. I'm sorry. It's the same name different translations will give us. And who was this guy, Mephibosheth or Meribaal?
That's Jonathan's
son of Saul's son. And what do we remember about him? Please, God, tell me somebody remembers this. Crippled in both feet. Okay. So how well could Meribaal travel? Not well unless he was mounted on something, and Meribaal's not there. So we don't know what Meribaal's doing. We just know that David takes Ziba at his word, and says everything owned by Meribaal is yours. And Ziba says, thank you. And you think to yourself, something interesting just happened, but I wonder what. What happens next? Verse 5. Somebody comes out and starts cursing and throwing stones at the king and at all of his retinue. This is verse 5 and then into verse 6. Do you see that? Now, these are toughened warriors, some of them. They may be a little old, but I have a coffee cup that says, age and treachery will always defeat youth and skill. There is some truth to that. What does David do? The words of the curses were these: off with you, off with you, man of blood, scoundrel. The Lord has paid you back for all the blood spilt of the house of Saul, whose sovereignty you have usurped. And the Lord has transferred the sovereign power to Absalom, your son. Your wickedness has overtaken you, man of blood that you are. Abishai, who was one of the military heroes, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and cut off his head. Would you just let me do that? And the king says, let him be. Maybe God has told him to do this. And why should I stop his mouth if God has told him to do this? Verse 12, on the other hand, maybe God will know that these curses are false and will therefore take greater pity on me and repay me with good for this man's curses, it says. So off they went with this fellow. What's his name? Shimei. We've had Hushai, now we've got Shimei. Keeping pace with him along the opposite mountainside, cursing as he went, throwing stones, I think there's a footnote that says something else, and flinging dust. And all the king and all the people who were with him arrived exhausted at a certain place where they finally drew breath. My translation doesn't say what that place is. Does yours? Near the Jordan, but not across the Jordan, right? Okay. Verse 15, Absalom entered Jerusalem with all the men of Israel. With him was Ahithophel. Mm-hmm. Hushai came up to him and offered him help. Absalom says to Hushai, is this your faithful love for your friend? Meaning David. Why did you go away with your friend? Meaning David. And Hushai replied, no, the man whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel have chosen, he's the man for me. And with him I will stay. And for the first time, Absalom gets fooled where he's been fooling everybody else all along. As I served your father, so will I serve you, it says in verse 19. Verse 20, Absalom said to Ahithophel, what should we do? Think carefully. And Ahithophel offers a horrible suggestion. He left some concubines behind. Go take them in broad daylight. Because once you take that step, people will know there's no way back. Your rebellion will be permanent. There'll be no mending of fences with David after that. And he does so. Verse 23, at the time, whatever advice Ahithophel gave was treated like a decision obtained from God. As it was by David, so it was by Absalom. In this way was all of Ahithophel's advice regarded. Chapter 17, Ahithophel now offers his second piece of advice. What's his second piece of advice? Go get them, my friend on the front suggests. Chase them now would be another way of saying it. Go get them. Let me choose, Ahithophel said to Absalom, let me choose 12,000 men, set off this very night. I'll fall on him while he's tired and dispirited. I will strike terror into him, and all the people who are with him will run away. I'll only kill the king. And then I'll bring all the people back to you like a bride returning to her husband. You seek the life of one individual only, the people as a whole will have peace. This suggestion seemed a good one to Absalom and to all the elders of Israel. Why did it seem good? Because that was sound advice if he wanted to succeed in his rebellion. And now, Absalom said, what? I want a second opinion. I want a second opinion. Go get who shot, when shot, why shot, what shot. I'm trying to make you smile a little bit. Are you tolerating this? Is this okay? Is this okay? Let's hear what he has to say. When Hushai had come, Absalom said, this is what Ahithophel suggested. He rehearses that apparently. Are we to do as he suggests? If not, suggest something yourself. And Hushai said to Absalom, you know, for the first time, I think Ahithophel has made a mistake. What does he basically say? He may be an old bear, but he's still a bear. And the men with him may not be big in number, but they are tough. You go after them now, they're going to maul your men. Better that you prepare a bigger force than this and wait a while. I think that's the gist of what follows. Does that line up with what you're reading? Okay. Verse 14. God answers David's prayer. Absalom and all the people of Israel said, Hushai's advice is better than Ahithophel's advice. The Lord having resolved to thwart Ahithophel's shrewd advice and in that way bring disaster on Absalom. Hushai then started the chain of communication that led out to David, who was very nearby in the desert. And if you remember from verse 14 of chapter 16, he and all the people with him were exhausted. And what did they say? Ahithophel gave, I love the way my translation reads this, such and such advice. That's like saying blah, blah, blah. And the elders of Israel, but I advise so and so. Mine says, he said such and such, but I said so and so. Send with all speed to David and say, don't camp in the desert passes tonight. Get through them as fast as you can, or the king and his whole army may be annihilated. Off they went, warned them. And they got chased a little bit by Absalom's people. Somebody faithful hid them in a well, I think it says. But the word finally gets to them. And verse 22 of chapter 17, David and all his troops with him set off. And the very important three words, what does it say?
Across
the Jordan. Across the Jordan. By dawn, no one was left. That was the big thing they had to do, cross the Jordan. When Ahithophel saw that his advice had not been followed, what did he do? He committed suicide. Which means he's not going to give any advice anymore. Verse 24. Where has David got to? Can we agree on a pronunciation of this one? Manahaim, okay with you? I don't think it's the steamroller. Mahanaim, is that better? I want to say Manahaim steamroller, but I don't think that works. It's Mahanaim. Is that good enough for today? He had reached Mahanaim by the time Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. Verse 25. It starts to get complicated. Remember palace intrigue I told you about? Absalom had put someone in command of the army. Amasa. In place of
Joab.
Joab was the army commander when David was king. Absalom comes in. He didn't want Joab in charge. Besides, Joab is with David. So he puts who?
Amasa
in charge. This Amasa was the son of a man called Ithra, an Ishmaelite, who had married Abigail, who was the daughter of Jesse. Who's Jesse? David's father. If this is the daughter of Jesse, who's that? David's sister. This is David's nephew. Right? She is the daughter of Jesse and the sister of Jeroiah. If she's the sister of Jeroiah, what does that tell you?
I don't know.
That's another one of Jesse's daughters. This is another sister of David. And
Joab.
Her son is
Joab.
Holy mackerel. You need a review of that one? Now, if you've been faithful, if you've been here every week I've been teaching for the last maybe 5 or 6 weeks, I've been building this up to you. All of these people are very, very closely related. There is a sense of trust that is almost Sicilian. I found myself thinking about the movie The Godfather, and doing that in this context seems a little silly, and I agree that it's a profane parallel, but there's still a parallel.
Well, you said Jesse, but I don't see his name.
I don't
mean you have Nahash, I have Jesse. And I'm assuming Jesse means Jesse, and there's two other translations I think that have that as well. I didn't realize all of them didn't have that. I should look more carefully. Israel and Absalom and Amasa pitched their camp in the territory of Gilead. Okay? Now, we are unfortunately out of time. And I hate this because we're in the middle of one of the best stories you'll ever see. Let's take 1 second. The clock on the wall is set deliberately a few minutes fast, and we do have 30 minutes before the next thing starts. But let's just take 1 second. This last little bit, when David reached Mahanaim, is that what we agreed to call it? Three people brought him and his people food. It's got a long list that starts in verse 28 and goes most of the way through, maybe halfway through verse 29. They brought food, provisions, all this kind of stuff. Who were these three people? First one is Shobi. So yours says that's the same guy. Oh, mine doesn't.
My note says.
Okay, but where's he from?
Rabbah.
Where's he from? Rabbah of the Ammonites. What's the last time you saw Rabbah of the Ammonites? David was wiping them out. After the sin with Bathsheba and all that, remember, he caught up with them. And he had put those people into forced labor. Every one of them was put into abject labor. And yet, here's somebody from that place coming to give provisions to David. That's fascinating. That's interesting. Who's the second person? He's from Lodabar. Or Lodabar. Right? That's the town whose name means nothing. It's Nowheresville. A translation that would not be far off would be Nowheresville. And who's the third one? Barzillai from Gilead. A particular place in Gilead called Rogelim or Rogaine. No, I guess it's not called Rogaine. Okay. Where did Israel and Absalom pitch their tents? In Gilead. And somebody from Gilead is bringing in provisions. These people are doing this at their peril. At their peril. And we're going to leave off there. I have a couple of assignments for you. The first one is the only one I'm going to give you. In addition to reading forward, I want you to go read Romans 5, 8 and Romans 8, 28 and think about those two things in the context of what you just read. Additionally, I'd like you to read Psalm 3. Psalm 3, Romans 5, 8, Romans 8, 28. Read that in the context of what you're saying. Psalm 3. And we're going to have to stop at that point because the clock on the wall says we can't go any further without being unresponsive to your needs to stop. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we see how quickly life can turn. How someone who is strong and in charge can suddenly be down and running almost for their lives, literally in this case. But we notice in the process that although David didn't call on you at the first, he is calling on you some. And that people from unlikely places are stepping out to give aid and to give help. Help us realize that people from unlikely places step out and give us help when we're in trouble. Help us watch for those that you may be directing us to help. And bring us back next week so we can follow this story a little more. We ask all this in your son's name. Amen.